Hi, I'm Robert Osborne. I'm back to bring you part two of TCM's private screenings, Uncut Sidney Lumet. Now, in the second half of my interview with Sidney, we pick things up with a very difficult period in Sidney's life and career, the blacklist era, when many of Sidney's friends and coworkers had their lives turned upside down by the House Un-American Activities Committee investigation into the alleged communist infiltration of the entertainment industry. Sidney was connected to many of the people who were on the blacklist and found himself briefly under the microscope of the committee, so he has a very interesting perspective on that subject, a perspective that was a great help to him when he made the film Daniel, which was a fictional account of the effects of the real-life espionage trial involving Julius and Ethel Rosenberg. We'll talk about that film as well as other such acclaimed Sidney Lumet movies as Serpico, Prince of the City, Murder on the Orient Express, The Verdict, and several others. We also talk about his affinity for stories about the legal system and his favorite American films and film actors. He also reveals Sidney Lumet's first law of films. All of that plus his thoughts about such talented people that he's worked with, such as Ingrid Bergman, Jane Fonda, and Al Pacino. So here, originally recorded in December of 2004, first shown on TCM in October of 2005, TCM's private screenings uncut, Sidney Lumet. Now, you talk about Sidney Buckman and the blacklisting. You came from group theater roots and all of that. You must have had a lot of friends that were blacklisted and all of that. Did you see a lot of lives destroyed and changed by that?
I cannot tell you. You know, when I try to explain it to my daughters today, they don't understand. How can anybody let this happen? You know. I see signs of it beginning again, by the way, today. And it happened, and it happened viciously. And I mean, the story that illustrates it all, when I was in My Heart's in the Highlands, I was 14 years old. And my father was played by a brilliant, brilliant comic actor by the name of Philip Loeb, who had a great career in Broadway. I don't think he was ever in any movie. And Phil was blacklisted. He had been playing Papa Goldberg on The Goldbergs.
On television.
On television. And Molly fought for him for a year and then couldn't anymore. The pressure became too great.
Molly Picon?
No, this was
Molly Goldberg.
Molly Goldberg.
Right.
And 2 days after, Phil, I owe everything to. He was the first one who took me to the Museum of Modern Art. He was the first one to give me books about painting. He was a mentor and a tender. He taught me tenderness more than anyone else. And 2 days after he lost the show, he checked into the Taft Hotel on 50th Street and 7th Avenue, put a Do Not Disturb sign on the door, and killed himself. And this was not unusual. There's a wonderful book that was put out by Viking Press when Tom Ginsberg was running the company, and it was called 30 Years of Treason. And what it was edited by Eric Bentley, and what it was the direct testimony of everybody we know before the House Un-American Activities Committee. Paul Robeson, Jerry Robbins, Ilya Kazan, you name them, there they were, Adolf Manju, Gary Cooper. And it's just the direct testimony, the questions asked and the answers given. But what is amazing about it is that Eric Bentley, in a little afterpiece at the back of the book, has about 4 pages of double column names of these are the actors, writers, directors who either committed suicide or developed what, in my opinion, Bentley's opinion, were psychosomatic diseases which killed them, like Lee Cobb and his bad heart, or Edward J. Bromberg and his death, John Garfield. because of their being pursued by the House Un-American Activities Committee. And I think there are like 84, 85 names listed.
It's amazing.
So it had its human toll.
Did it ever get anywhere near you?
I sure did. I escaped by the skin of my teeth only because I had a very brave sponsor. I was doing two shows a week for CBS at the time. One of them was this melodrama I talked to you about called Danger, half hour on Tuesday. I was also doing, on Sundays, a live, the live version, not the film version, of You Are There, which was a very successful show. Now, 2 half-hour shows a week is a lot of work. It also made me fairly valuable to CBS because both shows were hits. And these things, whether you had a hit show or not, affected it to some degree because there was money invested in you. There were rumors for a long time that Lucille Ball was going to be called before the committee. And Desi Arnaz put out an interview saying, "The only thing red about Lucy is her hair." That was the great comic quote. At any rate, she never came up before the House Un-American Activities Committee. But she also had the most successful show on television. And I don't think the two were, I don't think those, that was just an accident. I had a wonderful sponsor, a man by the name of Mel, I was about to say Mel Brooks. he made Amadon toothpaste and Picopay toothbrushes, and he was the sponsor on Danger. And he started being pressured. My name appeared in the American Legion magazine as having been a communist, which I had never been, having attended a Communist Party meeting, which I had never been at. And the pressure started. The pressure...
To fire you.
Yes. The pressure was very organized. It would always begin with a man, if my memory serves, by the name of Johnson, who owned a string of supermarkets in Syracuse. And what he would do is take your product off his shelf. So that it was the beginning of an economic pressure on whoever the sponsor was. Mel, when the pressure began about me, resisted it. Finally came to me one day and he said, "Sidney, it is really getting rough because not only am I off the shelf in Johnson's stores, it's starting to spread now into the Midwest." He said, "Look, you can tell me to drop dead. You don't have to do this. But I think I've gotten hold of two people who can clear you." Clearing of an actor or a director or a writer had become a profession by then. People were making money off of it.
And you hadn't been called before anybody?
No.
This was just rumor.
My name had appeared in the American Legion magazine.
And that was it.
And there were a lot of instruments like that. Dorothy Kilgallen's column, Jack O'Brien's column.
Hedda Hopper's.
Hedda Hopper, Ed Sullivan's column. Mm-hmm. All could get you blacklisted if you were named. And he said, "But I think would you be willing to come up to my apartment and meet with him?" Well, you know it. I mean, because it's the end of my profession. Of course I would. And yet it was extremely painful because there was a step in it. If you were absolved in any way, the only proof of it you could give was if you would name people you thought. There is a reason it was called a witch hunt, because it was exactly what happened in Salem, Massachusetts in the 17th century. And the only way you could prove you weren't a witch was to name other witches. And you know, I didn't know what I'd do. I didn't know, Robert, whether I'd behave well, whether I would behave badly. Because sure, I knew people who were left-wing or even communists. And so I didn't know what to do. But I sure in hell wanted to keep working. And so I went up to Mel's house. He lived just 8 blocks from where I did. And he lived in one of those apartments on Park Avenue that the elevator opens right into the apartment. And I walk in, and there are two guys sitting there. One is a name named Victor Eisel. Victor was a labor columnist for the New York Daily Mirror who had been blinded by the mob when he had connected a couple of unions in the garment district, which he identified as mob-controlled. And one day they threw some acid in his face, and he was now blind. The other person sitting there was a man by the name of Harvey Mattuso. None of you will know who Harvey Mattuso was, but Harvey Mattuso was one of the government's main witnesses, along with a woman named Elizabeth Bentley, who testified against the Communist Party leadership when the Smith Act was passed, making the Communist Party illegal. And his testimony and Elizabeth Bentley's testimony had convicted 11 or 12 members of the heads of the Communist Party. And they're sitting there, and I'm walking, and unbeknownst to me, I behaved well, which means I began cursing them out, screaming. It was a wildly emotional time for me. But I was calling them names that I won't even get hint at on the program. And Harvey stood up. He said, well, don't get yourself in an uproar. He said, you're not the one. And I started to in on him. I'm not the one, why, you son of a... Because this has been a slightly torturous 6 weeks. Mm. Whereupon Mel grabbed me from the bar behind and said, shut up, just have a drink. And we stood there, and his brother Stuart mixed some drinks. And then I got up to leave, and Harvey Mattuso got up with me. We walked to the elevator together, and he said, where are you going? Can I give you a lift? As if nothing had happened. But if it hadn't been for Mel's fight and persistence, I would have been blacklisted.
Talking about the blacklist, let's talk a little about your film Daniel. That's not a film that a lot of people know, but that is kind of a subject covered in Daniel, mm-hmm. about the blacklisting and everything like mm-hmm. that. Is that a particular favorite of yours, that film?
I think it's a terrific movie. I think it's a very underestimated movie.
Uh-huh.
And interestingly enough, pardon the expression, the red flag that goes up about that movie, which is that it's about the Rosenbergs.
Uh-huh.
And, I'm not a fool, nor am I afraid of it. Obviously, it's a political movie. Edgar Doctorow always writes political novels. And he did the screenplay on that, as you know. But what I found most moving about it, and the reason I wanted to do it, was not out of the politics of it. For obvious reasons, I'm very aware of what obsessive people, i.e. me, what my obsessions have cost my children. I think what happens basically in Daniel is that two parents whose lives are devoted, in this case, to a political cause, have no awareness of the fact that they are, in one sense, destroying their children enough to a degree that the children are going to have to save themselves. And one child can't, and the other child does. And it was true for me, and I wasn't in any way trying to deny the politics of it. But what the book and the movie were about to me were the cost on the children of parental obsession.
Mm.
And it was that I found so moving about them, and made me so happy that I did it.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, this was true for Edgar, too, because I told him all of this. And when we would talk about it in interviews, people thought we were just trying to duck, that we were being disingenuous. We were just trying to duck the clear political implications of the plot. But for both of us, there was something more at stake than just the plot. There was an emotional truth behind it that certainly for me was far more important.
And some wonderful performances in that film.
Mm.
Timothy Hutton's terrific.
And Mandy Patinkin is incredible.
Now, going back a little bit, Serpico, another great Sidney Lumet film. That was your first one you'd done with Dee Dee Allen,
right,
the editor. And she once said about you, Sidney is the kind of man who knows exactly what he's going to shoot, what kind of lens, how the angles are going to look. He is extremely organized. And you're kind of famous for cutting in the camera, not shooting things that you're not going to use. Mm-hmm. Did that start early on, way back?
Yes, that came, I was talking about that, Robert, when I was talking about learning editing in live television. You see, the thing that was true in live television and is also true in the theater, both of those being the areas that I came from, is that you're making the dramatic selection in advance.
Mm.
You're not trying this, trying that, and coming to a conclusion, oh, it's this. It's a third thing. In the theater, this is what the play is about. This is what we aim for. And you sink or swim with it. Clearly, that has to be on a live television show as well. So I don't think there's any superiority in that as a way of making movies. There are other directors. I would shoot, if I shot 100,000 feet of film on a movie, that was a lot. I think on 12 Angry Men, I don't know why I remember this, I exposed 72,000 feet of film, which is nothing. The completed picture is 10,000 feet, you know. As opposed to a director like Willie Wyler, for instance, a great American director. And Willie would shoot 1,400,000 feet for a movie. George Stevens. 1,500,000 feet.
And then cut in the editing room.
Exactly.
Decide then.
And then they discover the movie in the editing room.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no superiority in any one of these methods.
It does keep the budget down.
It does. It helps.
Now, Pacino, again, you've worked with so many incredible actors. You know, we're talking about Brando and Mignani and Fonda and Katharine Hepburn and Bergman and all of those. Talk about Pacino a little, because you've had two great successes with him, Serpico and Dog Day Afternoon.
The most moving thing about Al, for me, in working with him, is that he keeps you honest. He's incapable of anything false in the acting. If it doesn't happen to him, there won't be anything there. It's not like when Marlon could give you the exact same take again, only without really acting it. Al, if there's nothing there, he's empty. He'll forget his lines. So that's thrilling, because if something is wrong, if he's having difficulty, it could be very well be some sort of dishonesty on your part. You may have staged it falsely. There may be a forced line. There might be an inorganic piece of business. There's a reason for it. Because when he is full and sailing, nothing gets in the way. He's a glory. And I can't wait to see the performances that we're going to see from him. We've seen great performances from him. And I haven't seen Merchant of Venice yet. I can't wait.
Now, this is one of your so-called cop pictures where you talk about the police in New York City and everything, and you've done several. Is that a subject that in itself fascinates you, about police protection and
the law
police?
Fascinates me. It fascinates me, and maybe it's part of the Blacklist experience. I don't know. I'm not that introspective, but if the law doesn't work, nothing's going to work in a democracy I'm talking about. And God knows, during blacklisting time, the law collapsed completely. So, for some reason, Well, there's also a very simple and apparent reason for liking cop pieces or courtroom dramas, which is they've got a built-in conflict right away. In a cop picture, there's a good guy and a bad guy. Paddy Chayefsky used to say, I'll tell you how you tell the difference between a good guy and a bad guy. The good guy has a pet the dog scene. The bad guy has a kick the dog scene.
That about sums it up.
Paddy got to it, right? And so the built-in conflict, whether it's in a court case, whether it's in what a policeman is looking for, is there. It's dramatic, but just in its nature. So that's another reason I like them. It makes my work easier.
Was that a hard film to shoot? Shooting on the streets of New York? And
it was very hard because I had no time. I also replaced somebody in that about 5 weeks before we started shooting.
One of the actors?
Another director.
Uh-huh. Oh, you replaced. You took over for another director.
I took over. And the problem was that Al was committed already. He had to go do Godfather 2. That date was already set for some day in September. And we began July 4th holiday. So we had to work quickly. There was no way of postponing it when I took over. So there was a lot of, and the script was not complete. So there was a lot of ground to make up.
So you came in kind of at the last minute.
Yeah. And there was a lot of revision to be made in the script.
Mm. You've done some script writing, certainly nominated for an Academy Award for Prince of the City, but you haven't done a lot of writing, or you didn't do a lot of writing early on.
I still don't really consider myself a writer.
Mm.
Balzac, that's a writer. Lebrun Lardner Jr., that's a writer. You know, Larry Gelbart, that's a writer. I know cops well. I know the law well. So when certain subject matters come up, I feel very confident about getting the sound right. Prince of the City, I was ahead from the beginning because I had Bob Lucy's tapes. I had his actual tapes that he, the real tapes, the dialogue that went on in those, 35% of that movie is made up of the real tapes. Mm. I mean, wow, you're
great
way
guy,
ahead.
Yes.
You know,
yeah.
Expressions I'd never heard before. Clip him. He's going to clip him. Knock somebody off. I'd never heard that word, clip. What a marvelous word.
Yeah.
So the sound becomes easy, but I would not consider myself a writer.
What about the producer in you? You've done that a few times where you've directed and produced.
Most of the time you become a producer just to save yourself the energy of fighting with somebody. There are so few good ones, Robert, that most of them don't know the business. They don't know what they should know. They don't know what the crew should cost. They don't know what that dolly track costs. They don't know what the cameras cost. They don't know anything. And they're usually, I don't have to tell you, a great many producers, I think it's changing a little now, but they were agents. They were ex-agents, as are a great many heads of studios. And they've never been on the floor. They don't know what's going on the floor. They don't know if I'm using their money well or wasting it. So then maybe they've got some artistic validity about them. Maybe they're good on script or imaginative about casting and can contribute that way. But not many.
Some become producers. They just want to be on the set and meet girls.
Yeah. Yeah, but listen, I was told by a friend of mine who joined the Communist Party at a very early age that was the main reason he joined. Free love.
A true politician. Now also, we come to now one of my very favorite Sidney Lumet films, Murder on the Orient Express. Great cast. Oh, I mean, incredible cast. And again, shot in a confined space. This was a totally different kind of film for you, period piece, shot in London, I believe.
Shot in London, Istanbul and Paris.
Right.
Not a bad idea.
But I mean, you had everybody in there. Sean Connery again. And I believe, didn't Sean Connery help pull the cast together on this?
Well, he did in the sense that it was quite charming. There are two, talk about bad producers. It was one of the few instances in which I had two wonderful producers, John Braeburn and Richard Goodwin. And when they sent me the script, they really had in mind this kind of nice little train, English train movie.
Agatha Christie. And there have been a lot of nice little Agatha Christie movies.
There have been the Miss Marple movies,
yeah.
You know, all those nice little ones. Confined Space. You know? And I said, well, and at our first meeting, I said, there's a quality to this that really thrills me. I'm, you know, you can get a British director to make you a nice little British movie. But I think we ought to make this a Hollywood extravaganza. I think there is a tremendous feeling of nostalgia for things that may have existed. I don't know. I doubt it. I'm sure the memory of it is much finer than the reality. But I want to do it with an all-star cast, a star in every part. I'm going to need 20 times the budget, and as you know, I don't believe in large budgets, because I want them dressed to the nines and the most expensive of everything. They listened, they were thrilled, but then, of course, we had to go talk to the guy who was putting up the money, and his name was Nat Cohen. He was a terrific London entrepreneur, and Nat listened to me. Paused about 30 seconds, and he said, "You got it, Governor." And I wasn't used to things happening that easily. And we left, and I said, "John, Richard, he says we've got, does he have it? Is that legitimate? Are we going to get the money we need?" And they said, "The thing about Nat, if he doesn't have the money, he'll sell something. He is as good as his word. As his word. If he says you've got it, you've got it." And off we went. And, oh, to get back to your question, I knew that the key to that cast was to get, since obviously we would have to put a ceiling on the salaries, because otherwise we'd go crazy, is if I could get one hot actor to accept the salary and be part of the communal experience, a star who would not be playing a star part. And, of course, the first one that occurred to me was Sean, because I know he's full of that kind of...
Sean Connery.
Yeah. And I went to Sean. He loved the part. And as soon as I had Sean, everybody else came along.
So you got Vanessa Redgrave and Tony Perkins and John Gielgud, Ingrid Bergman, Wendy Hiller, Richard Widmark. I mean, Lauren Bacall. The list is incredible.
Yeah, it was wonderful.
Absolutely incredible.
And
I believe weren't about four of them doing...
Five were doing plays in London at that point. And Albert Finney, who was playing Poirot, the lead role, was in a play in London, if you can believe it, and had this two-hour makeup job. So he'd get back from the theater at after having had supper about 12:30, a quarter of one, get into bed. This is literally true. He would have to be awakened at 5. But he was awakened and in his pajamas stumbled into the ambulance where there was a bed and would go back to sleep only with his head up, and that they would go to work on his makeup, driving him out to the studio. And he'd arrive at the studio and they would lift the back of the head and put a pillow in behind him so that they could start on the wig. And the 2.5 hours would go by. He would have arrived at the studio about 6, so close to 8 o'clock. At 8 o'clock, they'd wake him, and he'd get into his clothes and on to the set at 8:30.
And work all day, and then go do a play at night. Right. Amazing.
But the English actors are, they've got the energy for that. They're fortunate as the French actors are. Our actors are very unfortunate because making their living, which mostly takes place in Hollywood, and doing what they want to do, which is to be in the theater, are 3,000 miles apart. Mm-hmm. The English actors, the French actors, they've got it all in one place. Filmmaking is television, theater, all in London. Same thing is true for Paris.
Now, Ingrid Bergman won her third Academy Award for Murder on the Orient Express, and I believe she was cast in another part.
I went to her. I wanted her to play the role of Princess Dragomirov, which Wendy Hiller, the role that Wendy Hiller played. And she said, well, let me read the script. She read the script. I came back 2 days later. She said, have you cast the maid yet, the nanny? And I said, no. She said, that's what I want to play. And I said, but Ingrid, I mean, the other is so much better apart. The maid has only really one scene, one speech. She said, I'm not being difficult, but that's the part that interests me. And if you think it's better for me not to play it, fine, we'll work together some other time. Over my dead body, we'll work together some other time. I said, okay, you've got it. You do the maid. And she won the award for one scene.
Yeah, and she's wonderful in it. Oh. And I remember her Academy Award speech. She kind of apologized through the whole speech for having won instead of Valentina Cortesa winning for Day for Night.
Right, and, she was like, Robert, how did you remember that?
So apologetic, and it was so charming.
And so true of her.
Yeah, yeah. Well, logistically, I understand there was a bit of a problem on that, particularly in the train scenes in Paris, because they were acting in their plays in London. So how did you handle that? You had to go to Paris for the train.
The train taking off from what was then the so-called station in Istanbul, we had a train. Now, there aren't many sound stages in which you can put an engine, a baggage car, six cars, and the train had been assembled in Europe anyway. There was only one place I could shoot it, which was inside this repair yard outside of Paris, the repair shed. It was the only thing that could hold that size train. So we built the station in the shed. Now, the sequence is totally, it's vital, because the glamour of the picture, the basic plot, from so many points of view, it's a critical scene.
This is where they're all getting on the train.
When they're
right?
all getting on. And so, of course, my five actors who were in plays didn't finish until late Saturday night, and, of course, had to be back in London on Monday. But the train yard itself, the train shed, had to be back in its French repair hands by Monday a.m. So I literally had, from about 3 a.m. Sunday morning till whenever the sun came up on Monday morning, a little over 24 hours to shoot the sequence. And it was an incredibly hard sequence, climaxing with the train leaving the station. And by the time we were lit, and by the time I had done all of the entrances, and it came out up for this last glorious shot, I think it's one of the best shots I've ever done of the train leaving the station, we were now 35 minutes from sunrise, because obviously the shed had to be open at the end because the train was going to pull out. And there would be all of modern-day Paris behind it. And this great camera operator, his name was Peter MacDonald. And he was Jeff Unsworth was the lighting cameraman, and he had worked with Jeff for a long time. And the shot was on a crane, incredibly difficult for focus, because it started with low shot of the entire train and therefore the entire shed, dollying in to the wagon lee symbol, coming around behind and the train going out the other way. Very difficult shot. And for 2 hours, Peter just drilled the crew on the crane over and over and over again, because he knew, I knew, and Jeff knew that if we didn't get it on the first take, we weren't going to get it, because by the time it got out past the shed, there'd be no way that we could back it up
through
through a rail yard that was now starting to come to life at 6 o'clock in the morning, and get a second crack at it. And Peter got it on the first shot, on the first take.
We have to also talk, you had to fly those actors from London to get them to Paris, too. Just the logistics of that.
We had a plane waiting in London. And
they all flew on one plane?
They all flew on one plane, came over. And then the same thing, getting them back for their evening performance.
Incredible. Incredible. What a wonderful
movies,
movie.
We can do anything in
movies. Yeah, it's a movie. Okay, then you had two other great hits, right? One after another, Dog Day Afternoon. And that was followed by Network, The Great Network. So you were on quite a roll with that.
Yeah, it's, listen, Lumet's first law, a hit is always better than a flop.
Does a flop really get in one's way?
It depends. Robert, to answer your question briefly, yes, of course. You're granted a certain number of flops, depending on how many hits you've had, and what the grosses were. And interestingly enough, you would think that in a profession that's so oriented to money, that it would be cost of the picture versus what it grossed. Not at all. How much money did it gross? I don't care if you only spent $1 million. If you only did $12 million, out of which you should come out with a nice hefty profit at that, $12 million's a lousy gross. As you know, Robert, by now, a picture is not considered a good gross, a good grossing picture, if it doesn't hit nine figures. Has $100 million mm-hmm. is now the criteria for a hit movie. So
it has to take in 30 or 40 million the first weekend.
Yeah.
To really be considered a hit.
Yep.
But Dog Day Afternoon has a wonderful quality about it that it does seem somewhat improvised. And yet I know you're a stickler for scripts and good writing. Was that just the actors
it
making
was,
it work
it,
that
it
way?
It was and it wasn't. It was a very difficult movie to do in one way. I don't think, other than the boys in the band, I don't think anything had ever been done about gay life in an American movie before. And this was not just gay life, this was transvestite life. Not only transvestite life, transsexual life. And I'm arrogant to this degree that I can't concern myself with how an audience is going to react, whether they'll like it or not like it. First of all, it's impossible. I don't know anybody who can guess, who knows how to guess that. Nobody can. Disney, Walt Disney, was as close as anyone ever has. And I guess now, today, Jerry Bruckheimer has a pretty good record that way. Other than that, everybody who says they know what an audience is going to want or not want, it's nonsense. Mm-hmm. Nobody knows. So when I hit Dog Day, because I'd been brought up in certain areas of New York, Brooklyn, all I could visualize for myself that was that on a Saturday night in the Lois Pitkin, which was a movie I used to go to when I lived in Brooklyn, in a rather rough section, that one would hear being screamed out from the balcony back at the screen would be unfit for any mother's ears. And so I was very concerned about the way an audience was going to react, because to me, the picture mattered a great deal. It's a picture that's about people not being the freaks we think they are, that no matter how outrageous that behavior seems, that we've all got much more in common than what seems apparent.
We should just say, for anyone who hasn't seen the film, it's about a guy robbing a bank or attempting to rob a bank to have a sex change operation for his boyfriend.
Right.
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 So that's strange subject matter right there.
Right away. And I said to the actors on the first day of rehearsal, I explained this fear of mine. And I said, I think the only way we're going to work around it is if you make these parts so your own, if you personalize them so that they see it's you up there. In fact, let's use your real names. Marcia, Ben. The names don't matter. The character names don't matter. Make it your own. We're going to pay you $2 a day for your clothes. I want you to use your own clothes. No costume design on this. No makeup. Make it as personal as you can. Because when we see that degree of humanity, then maybe we can avoid this pitfall. I was particularly worried, Robert, over the one of the penultimate scenes, just before they go out of the bank, when the Pacino character is composing his will, which is being taken down by one of the bank clerks, and it was the actual text of the will. And one of the lines in it was, "And to Ernie, whom I have loved as no man has ever loved another man." And that, of course, was the danger point. It was at that point that at the Lowy's Pitkin on a Saturday night, all hell would explode. So we started rehearsing that way, and then one of the actors, I've forgotten who, asked the logical question, what about language? Can we use our own words? Well, I wasn't going to retreat from the self-involvement. I said, okay, let's do it. And to Frank Pearson's credit, Frank Pearson wrote the script, and Frank was present at rehearsals. And he not only didn't object, he saw what I was getting at. The script was perfectly constructed. We never departed from his structural base. But as they improvised, they were coming up with gold. And so I brought my sound department in, boom man, sound man, and we started tape recording the rehearsals, the improvised rehearsals. And at that night, a battery of secretaries would type up a transcript of what was on the tape, and Frank and I would sit down, edit the repetitions out, so on and so forth, so that by the time we started shooting, we did have a script, but I would say 40-50% of the language of it had been improvised during rehearsal. Mm-hmm. And to Frank's everlasting credit was that his ego was mature enough and strong enough that he saw that this was important for the picture. He realized the bigger need going on. And in my view, that's giant-sized talent. And as far as I'm concerned, he deserved that Oscar. Also, by the way, I think I said it before, we absolutely stuck with his structure. Not one scene got shifted in any way.
And that same Frank Pearson was the president of the Academy the night you got your special Academy Award.
That's
interesting.
I didn't bribe him, nor did he bribe me.
Okay, now, the next one was Network. You know, one of your all-time great films. Certainly a very, very acknowledged Academy Award film. 10 Oscar nominations and all those awards for Peter Finch. And William Holden was nominated. Beatrice Straight won. Faye Dunaway won, etc.
Ned Beatty, I think he got 5 acting
He was nominated, yes. Yeah. Five nominations just for acting. So how did that come to you, Network?
Patty Chayefsky was one of the finest American writers. I'm not going to say screenwriter or playwright. A writer is a writer.
And now, he did it all.
When I said before, I'm not a writer, Patty Chayefsky was a writer. And these subject matters stewed within him over long periods of time. I remember that he came to me 2 years before I ever heard from him again, saying, "Listen, would you ever like to do a show, a movie about our television days?" I was in love with Patty's work, as almost everybody was. I said, Patty, just call me. 2 years later, he brings the script over to the house. And he he asked me to come up to the office. And he hands me the script. And I said, good, Patty, I'll take it home and read it. He said, read it here. Now, Patty was a very litigious person. If there was a possible lawsuit involving anything, that interested him far more than what the subject matter was. And I said, Patty, I knew this about him. I said, Patty, I promise you, no one else will see it. I'm not going to make a copy and send it to my agent. And only after I swore six times that I'd be the only one to read it, did he let me out with it. Needless to say, read it that night, called him that night, totally in love. It's one of the few scripts, even though certain things occurred to me and we talked them through, I don't think I changed three words in that script from what I originally read. Mm-hmm. Full blown from the head of Zeus. And Patty himself, one of the major experiences in my life of working with somebody of such knowledge and funny. He was a funny, funny guy.
Now, when you read it back then, did it seem like a satire then? Or did you already know that it was happening?
I promise you, Robert, Patty and I, whenever we'd be asked the same about this brilliant satire, and we'd keep saying, it's not a satire, it's sheer reportage. The only thing that hasn't happened yet is nobody's been shot on the air. That's the only thing. Everything else has happened. And everything else had happened.
Mm-hmm.
One of Patty's closest friends was John Chancellor, who was NBC's main anchor before Tom Brokaw took over. He knew the world thoroughly. Walter Cronkite was a good friend of Patty's. And there was nothing invented. I mean, yeah, clearly the Faye Dunaway character. However, it's interesting, when a picture's a hit, even if the character is as, shall we say, ignoble as the Dunaway character, every female executive in television was going, it's about me, it's about me. Because the picture was a hit.
Did you get a lot of flack from people that were in the media about it?
The big thing we got was, how could you bite the hand that feeds you?
Ah.
And the answer was always very easily. Television put its own hand out to be bitten. We didn't invent anything.
Was Peter Finch always your first choice?
No, he wasn't, because I thought it was very essential that it be an American. And I've forgotten who else we went to. Patty wanted him right away. I fought it. And Patty was remorseless when he was after something. Just wouldn't stop. And finally, one day, he said, is his accent the only, because Peter was Australian, you know, and had been in the English theater a lot. He said, is his speech the only thing that bothers you? I mean, you're not going to worry about where he looks. And I said, no, just the speech. 1 week later, I get a tape from Peter Finch reading the New York Times with an American accent.
Mm.
Patty had called him. He was living in Jamaica, I think, somewhere in the Caribbean. Told him what the problem was and said, you can do it, Peter, right? Peter said, of course I can do it. And made a tape up and sent it to me.
And
that was it.
One of the ones that I never felt ever gets quite the credit for that they deserve as an actor, although he got an Oscar nomination, is William Holden.
Oh.
He's such a hub of that whole film.
He is the maypole
rock
around,
yeah,
which the whole thing,
yeah,
revolves. He's enormously moving and an unbelievably skillful and profound performance.
Mm-hmm.
He's the one who moves that picture from some dimension larger than television. He's the one who moves it onto a human, totally human level. because Finch's character is a total eccentric and a lunatic. Faye's character, nothing need be said. Ned Beatty's character is the wild man. And so that the scene between William Holden and Beatrice Straight about the divorce is one of the most human things and provides the whole human base to that movie. Mm-hmm.
Now, shortly after that, you did your first and only musical, The Wiz. Was that a great experience, working with music?
The best.
Was it?
The best. God knows we made our errors. I was in over my head in certain respect. Technically, I was in over my head. I'd never done green screen, what was in those days called blue screen before. I didn't really know how to shoot dance. And yet, I cannot tell you the lift that your spirits get when you roll camera, do the sticks, and then you call out playback, and that music comes out, yeah. and you begin shooting. It's just as badly as I did that movie. I hope somebody has the courage to ask me again.
Why do you think you did it badly?
I did it badly because I kidded myself. Diana Ross is a heck of a fine actress. She's a good singer. And I bought a rationalization about her playing that part. The story, and this goes right back to Frank Baum, is literally, there's no place like home. That's the last line of the great Metro movie. And I had rationalized myself. I was scratching like this, Robert, that we could make her a school teacher, but she was afraid of life, and that this experience was going to let her erupt as a woman. And one day, I'm having dinner at Al Hirschfeld's house. This is right after I finished shooting. We were talking about him before we started this conversation. And Al, in that magnificent intelligence, which just cut to the heart of everything, he was telling me, how's it going? And he said, well, isn't she a little old for it? And I said, no, because we got this, doing this, with the script, with the book. And he looked at me, he said, but it's about a little girl. Now, of course, he was absolutely right. If Diana had made given the most brilliant performance, if I had directed it perfectly, it still wasn't going to work, because it's about a little girl. And it's amazing how one can deceive oneself in the midst of work. The self-deception is absolutely necessary because it's responsible for the good work, too. Uh-huh. But it can lead you down terrible paths.
And you were directing one of the great stars, who was your mother-in-law at the time,
right,
Lena Horne. And you've worked with a lot of your family members, actually. Didn't you direct your father? Wasn't he
in The Pawnbroker?
In The Pawnbroker, and you directed your daughter.
My daughter Jenny in Q&A.
And Rita Gamm, who you were married to at one point, said that you were the best director she'd ever worked with.
We only worked together in the theater. I don't think I ever did a movie.
But she said you're the best director. She says that to this day.
Well, certainly the best director she was ever married to.
Okay, The Verdict with Paul Newman. Another great film. Another great courtroom drama, confined quarters and everything like that. And maybe one of the best things that he and James Mason have ever done. Was that a pleasant experience?
It was a heavenly experience. I hate to sound like the old man on the mountain. But after,
well, you are.
But I am the old man.
You're the man on the mountain.
And after a time, you get to know what you're doing. So the problems fall away, and all you're really working on is how good can I make this? You're not trying to catch up. You're not trying to solve. You've gotten good enough to ask questions rather than telling of your material. And the most fascinating thing to me about that whole project, it came from a book written by a lawyer. I don't even know the name of the book. All I read was this extraordinary script by David Mamet. Yes, I want to do it. Called up, yes, I want to do it. Went to work. Little bit of reworking, not much. Cast. When the movie was over, when I had finished the movie, Robert, I read the book. If anybody had ever sent me the book to do as a movie, I would have said, are you kidding? It's impossible. This can't make a movie. I don't know where David got the slant on it that he did, but it was all his invention. The whole idea of a man who had to redeem himself for whatever reasons. The whole internal life of that piece, David invented. And it's the old thing. There are no rules.
I want to throw some other names out. Rod Steiger. We didn't really talk about Rod too much when we were talking about The Pawnbroker. What was he like to work with as an actor?
Marvelous. The hesitation that you saw was... Rod came to you pouring 10 quarts of water into a 5-quart pail. It was always too much. There was always too much thinking, too much emotion, too much. And that, by the way, is a much better problem for a director than an actor who doesn't bring you enough and then you've got to pump up. Because then all you have to do is bring it down, suppress it. And when the actor is as talented as Rod, when you suppress it, you're just putting it into a better pressure cooker. It doesn't disappear. Mm-hmm. All of that emotion is still there. He's just sitting on the expression of it. So, and then also because both of us were so involved in it as a subject matter.
The Pawnbroker.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And... I think he's one of the most extraordinary actors we've ever had. The first time I ever saw him, I still remember it. He was on some show on NBC, and I thought I had tuned in the middle of a newscast. He was playing an air traffic controller, mm-hmm. talking a plane down. And he just had one hand on his head and the microphone very close. And I thought, well, some sort of emergency happened at Kennedy or Idlewild, as it was called then. And they've got their camera into the air traffic control room. And this is a real air traffic controller. I mean, that's how the reality in Rod's work.
River Phoenix, running on empty.
My wife found a picture the other day of River and I sitting together on a bench while we were shooting Running on Empty. And I'm talking as usual, and he's listening. And our heads were very close together. The intensity of the connection between us was so complete. I was really devastated when he died. I would have sworn that River and drugs was impossible. There was a kind of farm boy health plus a kind of 60s optimism about him. He was a wonderful musician, by the way. I have a tape of two songs that he had written that he gave me, that I still play in the car. It could have been a giant career. I loved him very much.
Richard Burton, with whom you did Equus.
Again, talking about self-knowledge. When he came to work on Equus, in a way he was sort of a burned-out shell of himself. There's been a lot of hard living and a lot of hard drinking. I'm not telling any secrets out of school. He just had come off Exorcist 3, 2 or 3, which he had obviously done for the money. And the hair had been dyed very, very black. There's a certain kind of dye, if it's a cheap dye, and they were obviously trying to do that show for as little as they could, where, believe it or not, when you hit it with a certain kind of backlight, it actually looks orange. The fringes look orange. Lo and behold, first day of rushes, Richard has an orange aura about his head. Tony Walton was art director and costume designer on the picture, and we look at each other. We know exactly what's happened. It's something that you can't pick up by eye.
Mm-hmm.
And we know we have to reshoot that day's work and light him totally differently. And so when it came time, I had to go to Richard to tell him we've got to reshoot. And he said, why? And I will only lie to an actor if I have to. I don't like to do it. I've done it, but I don't like it. I like to tell him the truth. So I told him the truth. And this look of sadness came over him, because I'm sure whatever conflicts he'd had about doing that movie were now coming back to haunt him, because he wanted to do this part desperately. He felt it would be his redemption as a screen actor. And he said, well, maybe if I'm good enough, they won't notice that. Talk about self-knowledge, huh?
Jane Fonda in The Morning After. Another Academy Award nominated performance.
The most thrilling, spirited, indomitable, persistent. She sent me that script 4 years earlier. I said, Jane, it doesn't make any sense. She said, why not? I pointed it out. There were three leading parts, and one knew automatically that the leading man, the one she was going to fall in love with and go off with, audiences are not stupid, he couldn't be the killer, so it meant that the third person had to be the killer. 4 years later, she comes to New York. She said, I've had it rewritten. Read it again. I call her up. I say, Jane, same problem. She said, come see me about it. I'll come see you about it. She comes to the house. In 3 hours, she talked me into it. She is an energy. There's an energy beyond. She's, by the way, an extraordinary actress, an amazing actress, deeply talented. Tony Walton, who I've done a lot of pictures with as an art director and or costumes, used to say a wonderful thing about Jane. He said that in all of the years of reading about movie stars' children who overdosed or turned out to be drunks or were under arrest for this, that, or the other, that Jane was the first one who showed that that path need not necessarily be the fate of star actors' children. And that is absolutely true. She was the first and suffered for it.
That also full cycle there to the two Fondas. Yeah.
Absolutely.
You've hit most of them. I mean, Brando and Dustin Hoffman and Pacino and Hepburn and Fonda, the Fondas and all that. Any that you missed that you really wanted to work with or came close to working with and didn't?
Oh, so many. I just wish there were enough years left. Robert, I've never worked with Nero. I've never worked with Meryl Streep. A lot of them are women, by the way. Because I keep doing these melodramas. Like this last picture I did had 52 speaking parts. 50 were men. Streep, Michelle Pfeiffer, Diane Lane, marvelous. And Sissy Spacek, wonderful actors. There really are 30 actors. We're very lucky in this country. Most of our stars are really good. There are very few who are just a pretty face. Julia Roberts. God, what an actress.
Who are your favorites from all the eras? Say, actors and actresses.
I don't want to talk about our era, because by naming favorites that I've worked with, it makes orphans.
Well, the past. The ones I mean, like the maybe the aren't around anymore that were.
Buster Keaton. First of all, as a director. You've seen The General, of course.
Sure.
You've seen everything. There's nothing better than that. A movie can't get better than that in performance or. Walter Huston. One of my. To me, when somebody asks me, what are the five great American movies? Willie Wyler's version of Dodsworth with Walter Huston and Mary Astor.
Ruth Chatterton.
Ruth Chatterton.
Yeah.
Can performances get better than that? We were talking about Wallace Beery before and Marie Dressler. Well, so many in Grand Hotel. Joan Crawford. I don't want to start encroaching into our own time. And then, of course, you start with the European actors, Jean Gabin, Arletty, Simone Signoret. The list is endless.
So often you work with really high-powered names in your films. In Prince of the City, which had a great cast, but they weren't really well-known names. Was that deliberate?
It was deliberate, Robert, because, you know, when you're doing the story of a real person, your first obligation is, hey, folks, this really happened. Second of all, the last thing you want to do is trash it. However, in Prince of the City, as a subject matter, as a character, that's a very dubious little mixture you've got there. You've got a guy who turns in his best friends and his partners, four of them, a guy who rats. And to make that justified, we needed to have people that there was no previous identification for an audience, that they could come in feeling fresh about it. That's why I didn't want a star to play it. I didn't want Pacino or De Niro, because a star, by the nature of being a star, has a persona identification with an audience.
Right.
I wanted this up in the air, and that was largely because I didn't know how I felt about it myself. I'm brought up being a kid from the Lower East Side, poor background. I'm brought up with you don't squeal. That's my morality. So to keep that, I wanted to keep that ambivalence going as long as possible. I wanted fresh faces. And I did something I've never done before. I took a long time casting the movie, and there were, I think, about 135 speaking parts in it. Over half were civilians, were people who never acted before. And I've never done that before or since.
Well, it worked.
It worked.
Sydney, I can't thank you enough for being here. I can't thank you enough for your films. I can't thank you enough for your time.
Your questions were wonderful, Robert.
Thanks.
They really
Thanks
were.
For being here. Academy Award winner, Sidney Lumet.
Thanks.